We're going to get started, folks. We have quorum. So thank you. Thank you for everybody's patience and everything. So we're going rock and roll. Couple things before we get started. Welcome. Welcome to the Minnesota House of Representatives. The summary of our proceeding signs and place cards are not permitted. Of course, everything goes through the committee chair. No verbal outburst, applause, and other things need to be held to are not allowed. For safety reasons, if you're in the room, find your seat and stay there. Do not block the hallway or the entrance. Of course, we have house security and troopers to keep us safe and everybody in this room. We will be doing what we can to get done in our normal time. If not, we will come after caucus. I suspect that doesn't excite a lot of people, but our goal is to try to land this airplane beforehand. And if you've received an entrance ticket, please retain it. If you're going to go in and out, that makes things work a lot better at the door. So with that, folks, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 23rd, 2026? A member, please.
Make a motion.
Okay, so moved. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passed and prevails for February 23rd. The first bill that we are going to hear will be, first of all, that's right. There is an update to the agenda. House File 3136 was removed by the request of the chief author, so we will not be hearing that this afternoon. So instead, we're jumping right into 3521. 3521, and I'm the author of that amendment, so I will turn the gavel over to Representative Nadeau. He can stay sitting where he wants, or he can move into the center chair. I think he loves the center chair.
So. Call me the czar.
Your Highness, is that what you want?
Oh. All right. Representative Backer, you have an A1. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, let's move that amendment.
I don't have that. You want to describe the amendment quick?
Just tell I don't have it in front of me. I left it out there. Could you do that for me?
Page 7, line 28. We're deleting the number 1 and inserting I. Is that just a Roman numeral? Okay, yeah. That's it? All right. Any discussion on that? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
A1 passes to the bill as amended, Representative Backer.
So this bill here adds more beds to the Regents Hospital. As you recall, Minnesota Statute 144.551 prohibits hospitals without a bank bed license from expanding their opportunity and occupation and so forth. So with this said, in other words, Regents wants to invest their own dollars to expand to 85 more beds. And we've done this 34 times in the past, if my memory is correct. So with that, I'm going to say less. I'm going to turn over to my testifier. And I just want to say, I know Regents does a great job. We have a lot of good hospitals in our state. Region is one of them, Trauma One. Many years ago in the late 90s, actually brought down a patient, a burn victim, who got electrocuted by touching a utility line, and he only lost a pinky, okay? So, and that was, we took him to Regents. It was a transfer from our critical access hospital from Wheaton, Minnesota. So with that, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Emily Blomberg, and I serve as the president of Regents Hospital here in St. Paul. I want to start with gratitude to Chair Backer, chief author of House File 3521, along with bipartisan co-author representatives Hewitt, Nadeau, and Carroll for bringing forward this exception to the hospital construction moratorium to help address inpatient capacity needs in the East Metro. And thank you, members, for the opportunity to speak in support of this bill, which allows regions to add 85 licensed inpatient beds, bringing more timely care to the communities we serve, including trauma and burn care throughout Minnesota. I want to start with a quick story about Dan. Dan is a retired Ramsey County Sheriff's deputy who came to our emergency room with chest pain. He moved 200 miles north after retiring, but he was in town visiting his grandchild. I had chest pains out of the blue, and they kept getting a little more intense, said Dan, a two-time cancer and heart attack survivor. We happened to be right by Regions, and I knew that's where I wanted to go. They are the best. I've seen up close the great care they gave patients, taking care of so many people day in and day out, which is incredible. Dan was our 100,000th patient to the ED in 2024. I'd like to say that was an exceptionally busy year, but we keep going up. Regions is the East Metro's safety net hospital and level one trauma and burn center. We care for patients across the East Metro and statewide, often the sickest and most complex patients regardless of their ability to pay. We provide the highest amount of charity care in the East Metro. We're currently licensed for 554 beds. Best practice for level one trauma centers is to run around 80 to 85% capacity. At Regions, our daily occupancy of the beds that we are asking for, med, surg, and ICU, runs around 94%. That means that on two-thirds of the days at Regions, we have patients in alternative spaces, and that could be anywhere from 1 to 47 patients. This request is not a growth strategy, it's to ensure we have the inpatient capacity to safely care for the patients who are already coming through our doors. The beds authorized in this bill would be used for medical and surgical care phased in responsibly and aligned with staffing and operational readiness. To be clear, we are not seeking any financial assistance from the state for these beds, only the ability to increase our capacity. The result is better patient flow, safer throughput, and improved access for the communities that rely on Regions. We respectfully ask for your support of HF 3521. I'm going to turn it over to Rochelle Johnson for a few comments and then would be happy to take any questions you may have. Thank you.
Chairs and members, good afternoon. My name is Rochelle Johnson. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer and the Vice President of Patient Care at Regents Hospital. I'm here to support House File 3521, which allows Regents to add 85 licensed inpatient beds to our existing 554 it holds now. From a nursing and patient care perspective, capacity constraints show up as patient care constraints. When inpatient units are full, patients remain in transitional spaces, such as the emergency department longer, while waiting for an appropriate inpatient bed. That can mean care in areas that's not designed for longer stays. It means more handoffs, more noise and interruptions, less privacy and rest, none of that which supports healing. It also affects our teams. Clinicians, nurses, and interdisciplinary staff are constantly balancing competing priorities, finding safe patient placements, managing surges, maintaining quality while operating at maximum occupancy. Over time, this contributes to burnout and turnover when stability and experience at the bedside is needed. Adding licensed inpatient capacity helps us to do something basic but important. Put patients in the right beds, at the right level of care, at the right time, with teams and care areas that support high-quality patient care. These additional beds would be phased in thoughtfully, tied to workforce readiness, and focused on medical surgical capacity, where the pressure is felt the most directly. I'd like to close with a comment we recently received from one of our patients about their experience. They say, I spent 5 weeks at Regions and owe my life to their incredible care. I was impressed by how diverse it was. Through it all, I was treated with respect, kindness, and kindness by everyone. I wish the world was the same. After I left there, I tried to lead my life the same way I was treated at Regions. We can't fix everything by ourselves, but the smallest act of kindness can change a life, if not save one. Thank you to everyone at Regions. I wouldn't be writing this without you. Chair and members, we respectfully ask for your support of House File 3521. Thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you both. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 3521 before we move to member questions and comments? All right, seeing none, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Backer. Obviously, because I'm on this bill, this is a great bill. But I think a couple things I just want to make statements about why this is such an important bill. One thing is we go back and forth on the bed availability. We go back and forth on this cantankerous regulation that says a hospital can't build out their beds. I would love to get rid of this altogether. This was set in place back probably when Anchor Hospital was around, which none of you probably know or been alive at that time, was the former name of Ramsey. Then the Regents came about. But we used to have hospitals every 10 blocks in the cities. Both cities had them, and we had to do something about making sure that they spread the patients out. And I think we got to get back to where the new form of medicine is nowhere near that, what it was then, and hospitals need to have more beds, and I don't know why they need to come to us for permission. Maybe someone can help me with that who talks later on, but I also want to talk about Regions. Yes, it's personal to me, but it's also personal to the state. As we see one of our safety net hospitals having major trouble right now, Regions, not to say they don't have hiccups here with the cost, because as you can see, and we talked about charity care earlier, they provide $35.4 million in charity care. We don't pay for that at the state. We pay for it, sure, conglomerately, because health care costs go up, but it first goes to the employees and the staff at Regents Hospital to absorb that and do more for less. They also, again, I want to reiterate, and I'm sure the chair knows about this, the Level 1 Trauma Center. That's a lot of pay for readiness, and I'm going to probably keep sticking to that as long as I'm on health, what we pay for readiness. That's money that the institutions or that the EMS sectors have to pay just to keep people employed, keep the ambulance fueled, keep the ER with the up-to-date monitors, and keep a reasonable amount of staff that can handle 100,000 patients plus a year. And so the pay for readiness is where a lot of it gets hit. Regions absorbs that, and they're playing the game that they were told to play, but these are all things that we have to look at to make sure that these hospitals can operate, our safety net hospitals can continue to operate. And like I said, we also have to look at this as a statewide, this is a statewide safety net. It's not just Ramsey or Hennepin or Dakota. It is a statewide safety net. And the only question I would have is, Representative Backer, how many times have you taken a patient down to Ramsey? Or Regents, sorry.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Kerbacher.
Yeah, the one time that was a burn victim, and that was in the late 90s. Myself, personally, our crew's been down here before, but myself, I was in the back of the rig with that gentleman, and he did well. He works for Travers Electric to this day.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this whole issue, as Representative Hewitt mentioned, about why we do this in the first place is kind of, that question's been around for a while. I think this was started in the 80s when the medical arms race was what was driving up, or thought to be driving up, costs. So there was a lot of duplication of service, and then that had to be paid for some way. I think we are kind of in a different time now, but I think it does, to my mind, still make a lot of sense for the state, on behalf of the public, to kind of keep some tabs on what is happening in the hospital building world, because maybe now it's on the other side where we need to make sure there are adequate facilities rather than restricting facilities. But we do have a process in law now, I don't think I heard any reference to it, but we have in law a requirement to get a public interest review from the Department of Health. And I think that's still an important thing. And when you read those reviews, you do understand kind of a little bit more about the ins and outs of what we're trying to look at when we want to decide whether a project is in the public's interest. And so my question for the testifiers is, I know that one was applied for here, but I don't think you have it yet. And so I'm kind of wondering why we would move forward with this, or if you know, like, have they said when it's expected? I know it was applied for, like, back in August or something. So it should, I met, oh, I see Ms. Timmy on there to come up and talk about that. So maybe, Mr. Chair, if it's okay, maybe Ms. Timian from the Department of Health could come and answer the question rather than my having the testifiers do it secondhand, if that would be okay.
That would be great.
Why coming up here, MDH did publish a notice that the application was complete and their follow-up questions have been addressed completely as of October 3rd. Did you want to add to that? Okay, come on.
Thank you. Please state your name and answer the question.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Timian, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Health. Yes, our public interest review is being finalized, and we expect to have it public very soon, not as soon as this week, but we'll have something to share shortly.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so given that, you know, we do have this process. We have our public employees in the department doing this work, and it's coming out soon. And I assume that this bill probably, I don't know what, if there's a huge rush, as I understood, the hospital isn't out of beds. They're just wanting to look to the future and have more licenses. So I just wonder why we can't wait for the review so that we have the understanding that we have paid to have here and then move the bill.
We're laying over the Representative Chair, Chair Nadeau, and then Chair Leaving. We're laying the bill over, so we have asked the department to get that to us. Both Chair Bierman and I have asked the department to get it to us by March 10th. And so forth. So that's why we're doing that. At the same time, we had a little time in the hearing schedule, as you know, being chair, and we fit them in, but that's why we're laying that over.
All right, thank you very much. That is exactly what I wanted to hear, and thank you so much, yep. Chair Backer.
Thank you, Representative Liebing. Anyone else? Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question I had was the request is for 85 beds, and I was just wondering, I know this is building out to the future, but I was wondering in the next couple of years, I think I heard that there would be like 6 to 10 beds put into service right away, and apologies if that was said before I came up, but I just wanted to see what the number in the first couple of years would be again.
Chair and members, thank you for that question. That's a good question. So we could immediately use 12 to 21 of those licenses to transition existing spaces for inpatient licensed beds. So we would be able to use the bed licenses immediately to help decrease the constraints that we have with patients being in alternative spaces in our hospital to care for them.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just want to clarify that. I appreciate that. And Regents needs the beds they need, so supportive of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Any other questions or comments? I have one quick question, Ms. Bloomberg. How do you, when you you decided on 85, why not 75? Why not 205? Can you just share with the committee how you go about designing, looking into the future, how you decide on the numbers in this case?
Mr. Chair, thank you for your question. That's a really good question. So the specific request for 85 beds came from a pretty extensive market analysis and internal analysis. So we looked at growth in our primary service area, growth outside of our primary service area, and projected growth for medical surgical patients in the next decade or so. So it was a pretty thoughtful review, and we came up with 85 from that.
Thank you. Any further comments?
One more comment.
Yes, Representative Hewitt.
And I forgot to ask, and I'm sorry. Thank you for your diligence, Chair. Ms. Bloomberg, I'm just curious. We know that HCMC has now stopped taking patients from outstate unless it's trauma. Have you noticed an influx in census recently, as you are one of the safety net hospitals as long as North Memorial, too? But have you noticed a change in what's going on with that? They just did it 2 weeks ago, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ms. Bloomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That is another great question, and we have been exceptionally busy the past few weeks and have just started to track some of those discussions of where that could be driving from. But you bring up a really important point. And another reason that we feel we really need these beds, if there's going to be constraints on other hospitals in the metro area, we feel some of that will be coming to us, and we want to be prepared to that so we can serve our community.
Thank you. Representative Hewitt, follow-up.
I'm sorry. And then how is boarding going? I know that your ER, last time I was there, is boarding quite regularly. Have we seen that lapse a little bit, or are we still seeing boarding?
Ms. Bloomberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Hewitt, that's a really good question. We, right now, any day of the week, two-thirds of the days in 2025, actually, we have patients who are in alternative spaces. We call them boarders, boarder meaning someone who has come into our hospital who needs inpatient care, is over 4 hours stay in the emergency department, and they now don't have an inpatient bed. So any day we could have about two-thirds of the days in 2025, we had from 1 to 47 patients waiting for inpatient beds. And so that's why these beds are an immediate need for us, because we could immediately use them most of the days of the week at our hospital.
Thank you. Hearing no further discussion, House File 3521 will be laid over. What? 3521 as amended. Do I get the hammer?
The second bill we have for consideration is House File 1807. Representative Gilman, would you like to move House File 1807 to get it before the committee?
Yes, Chair. I would love that.
Okay. Representative Gilman moves that House File 1807 be recommended and be referred to the Committee of Commerce, Finance, and Policy. We have the bill before us, Representative Gilman. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for hearing House File 1807, which provides parity for non-opioid medicines for treatment or management of pain. It is intended to ensure that patients have the same access to clinically proven non-opioid treatments as they do for opioids. Pain is one of the most common reasons patients seek medical care, and every patient deserves equitable access to safe and effective treatment. No patient should face delays when accessing non-opioid treatments. Pain parity levels the playing field by what this does is pain parity levels the playing field by eliminating barriers such as prior authorization and step therapy that often apply to non-opioid options, while opioids are regularly dispensed immediately. First and foremost, this is a public health issue. Again, I just want to go into Minnesota had 678 opioid overdose deaths in 2024. 1,011 non-fatal opioid overdoses in 2024 as well. So again, House File 1807 doesn't mandate coverage of any treatment. It simply removes barriers like prior authorization so patients can access non-opioid therapies without delay. Because post-surgical pain peaks in the first 72 hours, prior authorization delays can deter physicians from prescribing these drugs, pushing patients towards opioids instead. And again, I've got lots of statistics. I will talk about cost a little bit here. Again, in a recent evaluation, the Department of Commerce found the cost of newer name non-opioid medicines is $15.40 per unit compared to opioid medications such as hydrocodone at $8.67 per unit, oxycodone, which starts at $4.97 per unit, and generic opioids, which can cost as little as a dollar. Again, we can go break down like how much per day this would cost. The cost that's not being factored here is when you compare these numbers with the cost of the OUD, that's opioid use disorder, The savings are staggering. The annual health care costs of treating a Medicaid patient with OUD averages over $16,000 per year, 2.3 times higher than the cost of the care for Medicaid patients who are not experiencing addiction. So with us today is Chris Fox of the Voices for Non-Opioid Choices. I'd love to turn over some testimony to him.
Yeah, thank you. Claire, if you can come to the table.
No, it's at Claire, not Chris. Claire.
Yeah, Claire.
She's actually online.
Oh, she's online. Okay, thank you. Are we set up for online? Okay, so today we do have right now one testifier scheduled to speak on House File 1807. We do have written testimony in our package, and our goal is to vote on this around at 20 after the hour. That it would be our goal, if possible. So with that, Claire, you can get started. And we would ask you to limit your testimony to 2 minutes.
Greetings, thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much, co-chairs, Representative Backer and Representative Bierman for hearing the bill. And thank you, Representative Gilman, for carrying the bill. And to all members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you virtually today. My name is Claire Nyechi, and I'm the Vice President of Outreach and Engagement at Voices for Non-Opioid Choices. We are a national, nonpartisan nonprofit dedicated to preventing opioid addiction. We strongly support House File 1807 and urge swift passage to expand access to non-opioid pain managements in Minnesota. While much attention has been focused on preventing overdose deaths, we must also focus on preventing addiction before it starts. Between April 2024 and 2025, over 48,000 Americans died from opioid-related overdoses. That's 133 lives lost every single day. And Minnesota is not immune. Nearly 70% of all drug overdose deaths in the state involve opioids. And the reality is, and we know from our constituency, that many individuals start their addiction after being prescribed opioids for acute pain, whether it be following a surgery, an injury, or a sports incident. And opioids remain the default treatment for acute pain, with up to 90% of surgical patients in the U.S. receiving an opioid prescription for post-surgical pain. Why? Because generic opioids are inexpensive and often easier to access at little to no cost to patients. And currently, insurance coverage structures are unintentionally incentivizing opioids opioid prescribing by making them easier to access than their non-opioid alternatives. This puts unnecessary risk mm-hmm. on patients. This also places a heavy strain on state resources. As briefly mentioned, a recent analysis found that beneficiaries with opioid use disorder cost state Medicaid programs an average of $14,000 more annually. Nationally, that's over $25 billion estimated in additional spending. And in Minnesota alone, that's an excess cost found to be over $465 million. House File 1807 ensures Minnesota's Medicaid program does not favor opioids over FDA-approved non-opioid treatments. There are already FDA-approved non-opioid treatments available today, ranging from nerve blocks, prescription analgesics, to NSAIDs, and studies have shown that these options reduce reliance on opioids and decrease overall prescribing. This is why we believe that all FDA-approved non-opioid pain treatments should be on Minnesota Medicaid's preferred drug list. For too long, opioids have been the default approach to pain management. HF 1807 is a common sense safeguard that removes barriers to safer alternatives and helps prevent addiction before it starts. We urge you to pass this bill, and thank you so much for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Before we go to other testifiers, I was notified by House Research that this does not have to go to Commerce, but will go to the General Register if it's passed out and so forth. So I want to update members on that. Right now I open up to, is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, we open up to members' questions. Chair Bierman.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gilman, for the bill. A couple things I wanted to just mention. As was mentioned a few times so far, the opioid epidemic is still raging. We're in at least our fourth wave of this. But I think it's important to understand that commonly prescribed opioids for acute pain from surgeries and so forth have significantly declined and are no longer the primary driver of the U.S. opioid epidemic, which is now dominated by illicit substances. That being said, if we can have a product that is effective and can address acute pain situations and that are non-opioid, inherently that's something that I would favor. But I did have a couple questions on this product, and perhaps the testifier maybe could answer this, or I'm not sure if the author would have that information, but what is the status of this drug in other states in the United States? Has it passed and in place in other states so far? And also in the world market, is it available abroad for pain control?
I'm Representative Gilman or our testifier? Or
otherwise, I do have one other person in the audience that would like to come up here maybe and talk a little bit more about the drug itself.
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you.
You can phone a friend, Don. I mean, Representative Gilman.
Thanks.
I'm happy to tag in as helpful. I can speak more broadly beyond just one specific product.
Yeah, go ahead, if you would like, yes.
So the question was the status of this medication in the United States. Is Minnesota going to be the first one, or is it available elsewhere already? Miss, I didn't catch
state
name.
Your name. Please state your name and address that question, please.
Claire can answer this more broadly. I'm Abby Parda. I'm with Vertex, who is the company who has the breakthrough medicine that is the first in a class of many companies working on this new non-opioid options. But no, the new novel non-opioid is there's over 21 states mm-hmm. that have open access with no barriers in place, and we see over 24 states have legislation right now moving in the same direction. And again, this isn't just for one product, however, this is for just ensuring that if someone goes to the pharmacy and they are prescribed a non-opioid, there isn't a barrier where, oh, you could get the opioid immediately, but you'd have to wait longer to get a non-opioid option. But Claire, I could pass it to Claire. She can answer more broadly as well.
Thank you.
Yep, I'm happy to just briefly corroborate that point. There are a number of FDA-approved non-opioid pain therapies that are currently available on the market. I cannot speak to the international aspect of that question, but I think it's a safe guess that they are also available abroad. These are ranging from prescription strength NSAIDs, nerve blocks, and things like that, that are really in dire need of a leg up to compete with the current practices with opioid prescribing.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead,
Chair. Just a question then. I just wanted to confirm that this is short-term acute chronic care that is not, long. This is really a drug that has passed testing to be functional for shorter term, but not longer term. So I'm wondering about people who have, they're not going to just go to their pharmacy when they have a backache and pick this up. This is really prescribed by a doctor after a surgical event for short-term use only. Is that correct?
Correct, as far as
go ahead.
Pain.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Go ahead.
It's for acute pain episodes, correct?
Okay. Further questions?
Yes, Chair, please. Barron? I just wondered if we could have DHS come up and answer a few questions as far as the process of this. I think someone from DHS is here.
Hi, Christy.
Go ahead there. Go ahead with your question, Chair.
Oh, thank you, Chair Becker. Ms. Graham is here for the
yes.
questions. What I was wondering about was how this would be managed through DHS as far as the procurement and its use in the marketplace as a short-term use product. And I'm just trying to establish how that is maintained once it's out into the marketplace. Mm. And on the formulary, Ms. Graham, how would it compare from a state cost perspective on the
Ms.
market?
Graham.
Mr. Chair, Chair Bierman, Christy Graham with the Department of Human Services. In terms of the cost, I can't speak to that, but we can certainly do a fiscal note. I will say that current law requires DHS to have and maintain a drug formulary committee, which, you know, works with experts in the community, physicians, psychiatrists, other expert physicians, pharmacists, community members, to get information that is peer-reviewed, that helps them decide which drugs should be preferred and which drugs should be on our non-preferred list. So this language in this bill would undermine that public process. It's an open public process that the legislature has set up. So I'll just say that at the outset. And that process is in place to make sure that as a Medicaid system, we are covering the drugs that are safe, are effective, and are most cost efficient. We also cover the drugs on the non-preferred list, but those drugs require potential prior authorization. In terms of your question around the duration of use and how that would function on the market, I'm not sure that I'm the expert to speak exactly to that. Our resident expert, Mr. Hope, is busy doing other things with CMS and activities that are happening at the department today. So he sends his regrets and said that I could share with you one thing to note about the duration is that the FDA actually, the approval for this the particular drug, the Journavax drug, is actually supposed to be for the shortest duration consistent with the individual treatment goals. And the treatment for moderate to severe pain hasn't been studied for more than 14 days. So that doesn't say it can't be prescribed for longer than that, but it does say that that's what the evidence is based on. And so our drug formulary committee would consider that information from the FDA. So the language on lines 2.19 to 2.23, I think, do give us some pause and question about whether that potentially undermines our ability to restrict the duration under which this could be prescribed at and covered.
Mr. Chair, one more question,
yes.
Please. So, Ms. Graham, how frequently are drugs put into the formulary in this method? You mentioned this one's not going through the formal review process. So how often does that happen in Minnesota that you're aware of? And there was a second part to that question, which was, anyway, well, let's do that one first.
Ms. Kwong.
Mr. Chair, Chair Bierman, I'm not aware of any other time when a drug has been added to the list in this manner. Obviously, it would take legislative action. So I would just, I would also say kind of in relation to that is in addition to undermining our public open process that the legislature has set up to determine what drugs will be covered without additional prior authorizations, part of, what that body does, the Drug Formulary Committee, is to incentivize, this is, I guess, one of the outcomes, to incentivize competitively priced medications. So this would undermine that ability effectively and set a precedent that other drug manufacturers or industry could come to the legislature and say, you should also prescribe, you know, the medication that we want in this manner, or pay for it under Medicaid in this manner. So I think that's important to note for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just the last quick question is,
please.
How long would it take to go through that process? Is it a year or less, or you could just say?
Ms. Kwan.
Mr. Chair, Chair Bierman, I'm not certain how long. Do you mean to get a drug on the preferred list? Mm-hmm. I'm not certain. I would have to get back to you. I apologize.
Sorry for all the questions, Mr. Chair. It's just an area I'm very interested in, and the more I think about it and look at this, the more questions I have. So thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm curious about the fiscal component of this. So Representative Gilman, did you ask the department for a fiscal note or a TA on this? Do we have it?
No.
Okay. Sorry. I was listening over here. I'm also very concerned. This is, this has all of the parts that we struggle with. It's got prior authorization. It's got exemptions from prior authorization. It's got an immediate requirement for a brand new FDA-approved drug to be, to just go to the top of the list without knowing what the impact what the rebate might be, what the cost might be. And those are things that I really think we need to consider if we're going to start going down this path, which I'm not sure I'm ready to go down that path. I'm not smart enough to be able to look at these and make a decision like this, especially in line 2.19 to 2.23. That's a significant component and problem. And I don't know what to do with it at this point. I would like to see the fiscal part of this before we're being asked to vote on it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Leland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Nadeau, you mentioned some of the very things I was thinking about. So we have this process, and the process is kind of set up so that we here in this political body where we're not experts are not making these decisions. And so now we're kind of being asked to skip that process and make this decision. And like you, I feel very ill-equipped to do it. And, there's a reason for that. One of the things, I also wanted to know what the cost would be, and I really think we need a fiscal note on a bill like this before it moves out of committee. And also, one of the questions I had, we now know that opioids can have these really bad ramifications at times. We don't know what the ramifications might be of these newer drugs. We just don't know. So kind of the whole discussion where there's an attempt to say, well, opioids cost us, addiction is really expensive. Yeah, addiction's awful. It costs a lot of money. We struggled with this whole issue for years and years. And Chair Bierman, I know, has done a lot of work in this area. But it's not as though every person who's given opioids gets to be addicted. In fact, opioids have some very good uses. And now I think the medical community is much more careful about how they use them. So kind of this implication that opioid bad, something else better, isn't necessarily accurate. We just don't know. It kind of adds to this whole uncertainty around this. So I'm with you, Representative Nadeau. I'm not ready to pass this today, certainly not without a fiscal note, because, we know that these things can cost a lot of money in our Medicaid program, and we need to be pretty careful about that, especially right now.
Okay. Thank you. Members, with that there, and we did exchange communication with Representative Gilman, what we're going to do is, in light of the fiscal note and getting those details, I'm going to lay this over, and then we can bring this back up as we get those details. So if there's no objection to that, that's what we're going to do right now. So it seems like we have an agreement on that. So with that, so right now, if there's no objection, I know Representative Elkins was on the list, Representative Hewitt and Representative Lee was on the, and Representative Bonner, with us laying it over, if we bring it back, then of course we would have you to do the questions at that time. Do we have a consensus with that? Okay, thank you. So with that, we're laying this bill over. Thank you, members, on that. And this is how the committee process works.
Yes.
We are, I don't know if we're rocking and rolling, but we're using the committee process. So thank you, members. So the bill is laid over. With that, now, Representative Gilman, you're back on deck. The third bill that we have for consideration is House File 1270. Representative Gilman, would you like to move House File 1270 to get it before the committee?
Yes, Chair Backer.
There you go. Thank you. We have the bill before us. Representative Gilman, tell us about your bill, 1270, please. Oh, also, I understand, is that correct? We have an A1 amendment, too?
Correct.
Okay, but tell us about the bill, and then we'll get to the amendment.
All right. So House File 1270 is it amends Minnesota statute in Chapter 147B, acupuncture practitioners. The current version of the bill represents multiple years of efforts by the legislature and the Minnesota Acupuncture Association. This bill was introduced in the 23-24 biennium and was previously reviewed and approved by the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice and was included in a bipartisan Senate health licensure scope of practice bill that passed the Senate. So the language of this bill is really simple in scope, and it seeks to amend the language that is no longer used or seen as offensive by the public as it pertains to the practice of acupuncture. It removes and replaces these terms with contemporary language in alignment with modern practices and follows the national trends referring to the profession. It also modernizes the practice of acupuncture. Again, the Acupuncture Practice Act was first enacted in 1997 and has undergone many changes over the years to keep up with the contemporary practice. House File 1270 defines and delineates the modalities, methodologies, and tools that licensed acupuncturists utilize with more detailed language than what's currently exist in statute. So with that, I'll turn over the floor.
First of all, we have an A1. We have a technical amendment. Let's do that.
Yes, let's do the technical.
We have an amendment labeled A1. Representative Gilman, would you like to move that amendment?
I'd love to move that amendment.
Okay. Representative Gilman moves that amendment labeled A1. Everybody should have a copy of that in their packet. Could you just briefly tell us about that amendment, Representative Gilman?
And I'd love to call on Ms. Clarkvist to please describe the amendment that we talked about.
Go ahead, Ms. Clarkvist.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 amendment replaces Section 10 of the bill, which amends 2024 statutes, with the same amendments but to 2025 statutes.
Okay.
So this is necessary to amend the correct version of statutes.
Okay. There we go. Okay, that's a very minor change, but thank you. It's important. Okay, Representative Gilman has moved Amendment A1. Any further discussion on the A1? Making sure it's the correct year. Okay, hearing none, those in favor...
Oh,
I did not see you. Representative Bonner? Go ahead. Representative Bonner, have the floor.
Sorry, I just had a question here on the amendment on line 2.9. It says bleeding. I have some questions about what that is and how we define that and what is that we're putting into statute. Because... I mean, I know what I think of as bleeding in the past, which were medieval practices, but I have real concerns about whether we're condoning something in statute that maybe we shouldn't be on 2.9. Could somebody help clarify what that means?
Representative Gilman, would you be able to do that?
Yes, I'd like to call on my testifier, please, to just describe that to you, please.
State your name and answer the question, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Nicholas Doherty, and I am a member of the Minnesota Acupuncture Association and the legislative chair, and I'm a licensed acupuncturist in the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your question, Representative. When we refer to bleeding in terms of acupuncture and herbal medicine, these are techniques that are done with a very, very small lancet or three-edge needle to elicit 2 to 3 small drops of blood from the patient. This is not a bleeding technique to elicit large amounts of bleeding necessarily, but can be shown effective for different types of pain conditions, headaches, hypertension, and things like that.
Representative Bonner.
I'm going to be very candid, Mr. Chair. Without more information on what is involved in that, you know, and the data behind that, I have real concerns about adding that into our statute without understanding the data and the science behind it. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to be a no vote on the A1 because I don't understand what that is. And I don't think that brief discussion was enough to help me understand. You know, as you know, I'm the daughter of a nurse. And the first rule is always do no harm. This should be about centering patients at the center. And I have real concerns about what that involves. And I can't in good conscience vote for an amendment that includes something that has not been thoroughly explained or understood, and we have no idea what the science or the backing behind it is.
Okay. Further discussion on the A1 amendment. Go, Representative Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in light of that, and my question is to House Research, are we just objecting to the word bleeding? Because I'm looking at line 4.9, and it looks like bleeding disorder is already in statute, and I'm trying to understand to make sure that. So maybe the question is to House Research: is bleeding disorder in statute currently?
Go ahead, please, House
Mr. Chair and Representative Nadeau, the language that you reference. Is language that requires an acupuncture practitioner to ask a patient whether they have a pacemaker or a bleeding disorder. The language that's in the amendment describes modalities that acupuncture practitioners can use to treat a patient.
Okay.
So bleeding is a form of treatment, I think.
Okay.
Any further questions? Representative Chair, leaving. Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wonder, maybe House Research could clarify again, because it was a little confusing exactly what the amendment is doing, because the term bleeding is actually in the underlying bill.
Yes.
And I don't think, so I don't know that the objection is so much to the amendment as it is to the bill. So could House Research just kind of explain again what the actual amendment is doing?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment replaces section 10 in the bill with an amendment to 2025 statutes. It makes the same changes. The amendment makes the same changes as the changes in section 10 of the bill. It just amends the correct version of statutes.
Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. Just to be, you know, so the amendment really isn't doing anything substantive. It's really just a technical update to the way the bill is drafted. So I think Representative Bonner's concern, which is, I share her concern, but I think it's a concern more to the bill itself.
Okay, thank you. With that, I would see no further questions. Nope, okay. All in favor of adding the A1 amendment to the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. I'll oppose. Motion carries. Today we will be hearing from one testifier that's right now for House File 1270. And then, of course, there's written testimony in your packet. And so with that, we have Dr. Nick Downtree?
Doherty.
Okay. Go ahead. And we would ask that you keep your to 2 minutes, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, thank you, Representative.
And speak up a little bit. You got a soft voice.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Gilman, for authoring our bill. Again, my name is Nicholas Doherty, and I'm here as a representative of the Minnesota Acupuncture Association. We are the state's only professional association and largest professional association for licensed acupuncturists. I am a licensed acupuncturist working in one of our larger healthcare organizations here in the Twin Cities. And also I serve as the vice chair of the National Certifying Board for Acupuncture and Herbal Medicine, the NCBAHM. As I stand here today, I speak only on behalf of the Minnesota Acupuncture Association. HF 1270 represents, again, as Representative Gilman said, multiple years of efforts from our organization, working in conjunction with many other healthcare organizations and professions, to modernize Minnesota's acupuncture and herbal medicine statute. This legislation is not about expanding scope of practice recklessly or lowering standards that currently exist. It's about updating outdated statutory language so that it accurately reflects modern education, clinical training, and healthcare integration that licensed acupuncturists receive. These efforts started as an outcry from the public over controversial verbiage that exists in current statute. While those efforts did not affect change at that time, the association took the outcry as a sign that statutory updates that had not been done in some time to the Acupuncture Practice Licensure Act needed to be done. This additionally follows national trends across the profession to remove such language and replace it with that of acupuncture and herbal medicine. Minnesota's current law was written decades ago, though acupuncture and herbal medicine is grounded in traditions years old since the practice's inception in the modern age. The profession, like all healthcare professions, has evolved substantially. Yet the language and statute does not fully reflect the way it is practiced in contemporary clinical settings. Outdated terminology creates real-world clinical consequences. When statutory definitions are vague or antiquated, they can create uncertainty about what falls within a licensed practitioner's scope and ultimately can affect patient access to care. HF 1270 refines definitions to better align with current educational standards and nationally recognized certification frameworks. That clear language strengthens patient safety by explicitly delineating professional boundaries and reinforcing referral obligations. Clinically, acupuncture and herbal medicine are increasingly being integrated into care plans for various conditions, including chronic pain, stress-related illnesses, women's health, neurological disorders, and a multitude of others. At a time when Minnesota is actively addressing opioid reduction and expanding non-pharmacological pain management strategies, it's crucial to clarify the scope of practice for practitioners such as ourselves.
And if you can wrap that up, please.
Absolutely. As Representative Gilman mentioned, the fact this bill nearly passed in the last biennium demonstrates two things. First, there's broad recognition that the statute needs updating, and second, that this proposal has undergone substantial review and collaboration. Bringing forward again allows us to complete this work that was nearly finalized. This bill had been worked on in partnership both with our allies in the healthcare profession, as well as discussed and vetted with the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice at that time during the previous biennium. So this bill does not seek to prevent or restrict other types of practitioners, nor does it reduce oversight, eliminate standards, merely clarifies definitions, modernizes language, and strengthens our alignment within the contemporary clinical settings. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1270?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
State your name in 2 minutes, please.
Very briefly. My name is Chuck Sawyer. I'm a chiropractic doctor, and I'm here representing Northwestern Health Sciences University. We're located in Bloomington. In addition to training chiropractic doctors, we train massage therapists and acupuncturists. We work very closely with those professions. All of us provide important non-pharmacologic care, principally for pain, and are important members of the healthcare workforce in Minnesota. We've wholly support House File 1270 because it brings the Acupuncture Practice Act up to date. As a colleague of acupuncturists, and I'm surrounded by them every day when I'm on our campus, I admire their skill, the level of professionalism. I'm clearly knowledgeable of their training, and it's time we update that statute. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we turn to member questions. We have Representative Keeler. We have you down.
Yeah, thanks.
Oh, good.
I thought there was other people. Okay.
That's
I have a
you.
Question. Looking at the original bill, not it's and I didn't see anything in the amendment that took this out, and maybe I'm wrong, but line 5.21, I think I need a little bit more clarification on what you mean when you say counseling and education regarding physical, emotional, and spiritual balance. It seems like what you're doing or what you're explaining, I can't really make it make sense on how it falls into physical, emotional, and spiritual balance. Could you take a couple of minutes to just explain what that means or what that how that interacts with the services that you all are saying you're providing?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your question. It's an excellent question in regards to how acupuncturists work in the spaces with our patients. Much of the work that's done is within a unique system of medicine that is very holistic and comprehensive, that deals not only with pain management and the procedure of acupuncture itself, but also lifestyle management as well, including physical exercise, emotional strife that can be caused by chronic pain and other types of illness, and practitioners are trained and educated on how to interact with patients in those areas.
Follow-up, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. A little bit more on, like, how you're trained specifically. I mean, I just think that, like, emotional and spiritual balance is just so much different than utilizing tool like what you explained to us on this, and that didn't I guess give me enough of an understanding of what kind of training you all have to blend those things together. I think it's okay. I just need you to explain a little bit more. What trainings do you have to be able to say that that's what you're providing somebody? That's a really big thing when we talk about blending those three different things together. There's a very large scope of what people take into their entire livelihood.
Go ahead, please.
Yes. Thank you for the follow-up question. And with that, the system of traditional East Asian medicine recognizes that mind and body are on a similar axis or and are not separated from each other in any significant way. And so interacting with a patient working on chronic illness has and does affect the emotional state of that patient. And so acupuncture also is well documented to help mitigate, treat, and other types of emotional disorders, including anxiety, depression, PTSD. And within the education of an acupuncturist, there's a multitude of courses that are specifically designed to educate practitioners to do these kinds of things. So this is not necessarily like we're not moving into mental health care space. This is through the work of acupuncture itself that does this.
Further follow-up? Okay.
Thanks, Chair.
Yes. If possible, we'd like to vote this before our time is over, and then we'll be back for Representative Pell's bill. But we have Representative Bonner right now on deck.
Very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have anybody from MMA in the audience?
Does not look like that, Representative Bonner.
Okay. So I guess I have two questions. I mean, some of this, it seems perfectly fine, right? You know, we're doing some cleanup, we're doing some language cleanup, not a problem with that. I don't have any issue with that at all. But there's two questions that I have. On 1.20, we talk about this as primary health care. And are we talking about this as if it's preventative care, and does that have any implications in terms of how it's billed? If we are billing this to someone, or is this something that someone is doing on their own that is not covered by insurance? So that would be my first, because primary, implying that it's primary care, could have billing implications, which means it could have a cost. And I don't see a fiscal note attached to this. We were told this is just purely scope of practice. So I would be interested in that. And then I still have significant concerns about, there's a section in there that we talk about a cold laser and bleeding. Those appear to be newer in this list of items and have not been thoroughly explained or vetted for their efficacy, the science, or what in can or what they are, and whether or not there is any potential harm or risk involved. And I guess I'm very uncomfortable without answers to those questions in moving forward. I don't have problems with the rest of the bill. I don't. I just, but those things in particular stand out as issues for me. And as I've said, you know, patient care and patient-centered care are the most important to me and doing no harm. And I'm really uncomfortable with not having answers to those questions. And I don't see MMA in the room standing up, or if there's someone else that can answer the question, perhaps, but I don't see it.
Do you want to address that? We do have only 3 minutes, so be brief, please. And I have two other representatives that have questions.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Address the question of primary care terminology, what this bill states is that the system of medicine that acupuncturists engage in, that being traditional East Asian medicine, is a primary health system. We are not necessarily primary health care practitioners. You know, I think there's a distinction between these two things, but the system itself can be a first point of contact for people, does include a continuity of care for many patients, and practitioners are responsible for that continuity as well as collaboration with other healthcare providers. To address the questions regarding the implements that are utilized in the treatment room, those specific that verbiage is a detailed list, more detailed than what is put in the current statute. So, as a product, many times of acupuncture point stimulation, many of these things can occur too, including small amounts of bleeding, and that is not an intention of causing harm to any patients. There are no acupuncturists that I am aware of is there to cause harm, and we take similar oaths to uphold public health and trust to do so. But they are tools that are utilized within the treatment room for certain conditions in small amounts in that way.
Okay. Quick follow-up. Are running out of time.
Just briefly, you know, small amounts of bleeding from acupuncture is different than saying that you're actually making a small incision, which is what you said to me. Those are two completely different things. I just want to be clear about that. And I also, if this bill is to advance, the word primary care has very specific implications and meaning. And I think that the way it's written in this language is not clear and needs to be corrected.
Okay, we're going to take our last question with Chair Bierman. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank the author for bringing the bill forward. I have a number of family members who are utilizing acupuncture for cancer pain, chronic pain, and I think this bill makes some licensure modifications that would be helpful and support the bill. Thanks.
Okay. With that said, members, we have House File 1270. Any last quick thing there, Representative Gilman?
No, Chair. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on this bill, please.
There is a roll call. We will do a roll call.
Okay. Where's this going? Is it laid over?
Chair Backer?
Yes.
Chair Bierman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Nadeau?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ryer?
Aye.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative DeBell?
Aye.
Representative Elkins?
Aye.
Representative Franzen?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Keeler?
No.
Representative Knutson?
Yes.
Representative Lee?
No.
Representative Liebling?
No.
Representative Mahmoud?
No.
Representative Perryman?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Rapinski?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Ben Binsberg?
Yes.
Representative Zelenstikar?
Yes.
Okay, members, thank you. We have 15 ayes and 7 nays. So House File 1270, as amended, will be recommended to be placed on the general register. So, and it prevailed 15-7. Okay, then we are coming back after caucus. Yeah, I'm going to recess it to the call of the chair. I'm estimating around 6:30 to 7 o'clock, but keep a check. We'll be in touch with Chair Bierman and so forth on that. So, because we have one more bill.
It's one thing for the motion to go.
Okay, what's that?
It's an entirely another to put it on the general register as if it's ready for prime time.
Can I do the bill now?
When it's
we can't do it now because we got judicial coming in at 3 o'clock. So,
and get it done in 12 minutes.
Public safety, I'm sorry. Public safety is coming in at 3. So, we're past their time. So we're going to be coming back after caucus. And the enforcer for public safety just walked in. So anyway, with that, we are in recess until the call of the chair.
You got her down.
Health committee comes back to order. Thank you, members. We're all excited. So with this here, the final bill we will consider is House File 2070. Representative Divo, can you go to the main area? DePell, I'm sorry. Okay, Representative Divo, would you love, whatever you want to say it, to move House File 2070 to get it before the committee?
Yes, I move HF 2070.
Okay, Representative DePell moves that House File 2070 be recommended to be placed on the general register. We have a bill before us. Tell us about your bill, Representative.
Chair Backer, do I need to move the A1 amendment as well?
We would first of all give a brief overview of the bill, and then we will take up the A1.
You got it. This bill is a bill that addresses a disparity within health records. So what happens is someone who provides medical care or a hospital, a physician, anybody in the health field has to keep records in Minnesota indefinitely. So forever until that person passes away. What that does is it builds up a very large load of medical records, and we have HIPAA laws and we have other laws that protect those patients' identity and information correctly and appropriately. However, they are vast and numerous. As you can see in this very small piece of paper, there's 45 steps that these healthcare providers need to go through to be able to get those records out to the individuals who have requested them. And the individuals who generally request these records are attorneys for insurance companies. And what that does is it puts an onerous burden on our healthcare providers. Truly, it does. If you have to go through these 45 steps, especially multiple times a day, you're spending potentially hours away from patients, away from giving individuals care, and you're taking productive time away from our healthcare workers. So this bill actually helps with the cost of healthcare in our industry also, because it would appropriately monetize for those healthcare providers the time that they have to put into getting these records out when they are requested. So apart from that, this really sets a standard. Every healthcare provider in the state has this mandate of this is what you can charge for these records. Right now it's $20. $20 is very, very low to go through 45 steps every time and to ensure that you have a patient privacy. So personally, as a business owner, I see 50 to 80 different patient records a day come through my business personally, and those are prescribed from doctors. So I don't have to extract any data or request them, but those individuals that are sending to me have to do that, and they have to store that data securely. So that is the bill. I tried to keep it concise, but it was longer than 2 minutes. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. We have an amendment labeled A1. Representative DePell, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I move the A1 amendment.
And so Representative DePell moves the amendment labeled as A1. I assume everyone would have a copy of that. Can you please share us the amendment, details of this amendment?
Yes, there's two parts to this amendment. The first part deals with refunding fee that was paid for these records when the records weren't available. They didn't exist. And so attorneys will request records, and sometimes it's found that those records don't exist. Therefore, if there is a prepayment for those records, that should be refunded back to the requester, and this sets up that modality. Mm-hmm. And then apart from that, the second part is actually relatively simple. It cleans up some language around year 2026 and changes it to 27, and also adjusts the maximum charge annually and guarantees that happens based on a price index.
Okay. Any further discussions? Chair Lieben, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Is it DePell?
It is DePell.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
For the record.
All right, good to know that. So I'm just curious about, you know, who you've had conversations with about this, because, I mean, obviously there's no magic answer here. Sorry, I can't see you. This room. But, you know, this was changed a couple of years ago, and I do think that it was too low. I'm a little bit concerned that the what you're asking for in the bill is too high, and I'm just kind of interested in whether you've talked to the lawyer groups or, you know, or is it the hospital association that's bringing these numbers? I mean, where did the numbers come from?
From my personal experience, actually, dealing with individuals who have to do this on a daily basis, they've complained to me for a long time. And I've been in this industry for 26 years now or so, and I've owned my business for 17 years. So I interact with them on a daily basis. We transact with health records on a daily basis. And what they've said, I would say consistently for about the last 13 years, they've said that the regulations and mandates that have been placed on them to provide these records has become more and more and more and more onerous. And there may have been a time when $20 was appropriate because it was really easy. They could just send the information. There was really limited liability also at that time. But as these things stacked up, it just took so much administrative time. And truly the sad part about it is that about 50% of these healthcare providers, they have to do it themselves. Now, 50% of hospitals, for instance, and so on, they might have a contractor that they work with, and that's actually very, very common for that 50%. They're big enough, and they can outsource it. But the other 50%, those are the mom and pops or the smaller organizations. They're the ones that are really, really getting hurt, especially rural areas, some suburban areas. There are definitely urban areas that are directly affected too, but it's my experience. It's my personal experience, which I don't think is anecdotal because I've worked with about 1,000 different doctors over my career in different fields. So that's where we got to the 250 is this, the stacking, the 45 steps. I mean, we've talked about process before in this committee, and individuals understand in this committee that process takes time, and to do it right, and especially when you're dealing with patient data, it's really sensitive and it takes a lot more time. And then you need the infrastructure in place. You need to share over HIPAA compliant servers, and you need all these different things, and all those things take subscriptions that are annual, and this money just keeps adding up. So that's kind of where that comes from.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, thanks for that. So I don't know what business you're in, so just put that out there. But I'm kind of getting the picture, though, a little bit. Thank you for that answer. You know, in the past, they had to make paper copies. And so having a per-page charge made sense in a way that it really doesn't anymore for electronic. And also from what you're describing, probably the healthcare provider, you know, a bigger one might be able to do it at a lower per-production cost than a smaller one. And yet what we have in the bill and what we have in the law currently is kind of a one-size-fits-all. So I don't know if I'm comfortable with the bill today. I mean, I appreciate your taking this on because I do think it's something that needs to be worked on and fixed, but I'm a little bit concerned that, with respect to the fact that you have talked to a lot of people in your life, I think that's a little bit different than, you know, having, like, people formally weighing in on it. And I'm just a little bit concerned that we're going from one extreme to the other here. I really like to see something with a little more particular rationale to it, and maybe even, you know, maybe it shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all number. I don't know, but thanks for your work on it.
Yes, Chair Liebling or Chair Backer, do you mind if I respond to that?
Go ahead. I'm Representative Pell.
So on the anecdotal side, the life experience side of things, I go to continuing education on an annual basis and have to keep up with that. And HIPAA and, of course, OSHA and all those different things are part of that continuing education. And this gets talked about in those sessions. So it is certainly practice-wide and objective information that is known within the industry. And you're correct about if we were just paying for the paper, I would totally agree with you. That'd be kind of silly and ridiculous to do a per-page thing. But the issue is that you have to make sure that it's the right information. Yeah. If you transfer the wrong information or you don't get it complete or in the way that people expect you to receive that information, then you really run into problems and you shared it in the wrong way, and then you can get yourself in trouble, as you probably know too. So the per page is really parsing through the information to make sure it's correct. That would be that side of the issue. Not the paper, just wanted to make that clear.
Okay. Representative Bonner.
Can you help
me?
Oh,
I'm sorry. I had Representative Purcell before you. I did not see that.
That's
so
fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll wait till we're on the underlying bill. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So, Representative Bonner, go ahead, please.
We're on the
amendment right now. We're on the A1 amendment.
Okay. Well, my question is to the I guess it could apply to both. Can you help me understand, like, who is it that's requesting these copies and why?
Representative DePell.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Backer. Oftentimes, these copies are requested, as I had mentioned, by insurance companies through attorneys to try to understand the background of potential litigation or the background of a life insurance policy or the background of somebody like that. That is definitely an issue that occurs and can happen in a different industry. I work in the dental industry, and so In those industries, you have, as you understand, multiple disciplinary portions, periodontists, oral surgeons, orthodontists, general dentists. All these individuals have to communicate with each other on patient information, and if that information isn't transferred appropriately, then, again, people get into big trouble. And so some of that stuff can move freely, but if there's issues, if a patient feels like there's malpractice or something along those lines, then it starts to roll into a larger process in which we're talking about. It's a bigger undertaking to try to legally meet the bar of this requested information.
Okay. Follow-up? Go ahead, Representative Bonner.
So you're using this primarily for things like insurance or legal proceedings, or those are the folks who are typically engaging these specific types of copies?
Most commonly, yes.
Okay.
Okay. That is helpful. Thank you.
Okay. And Representative Purcell, you're on the main bill, correct? Not the amendment?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so any further discussion about the A1 amendment? Okay, hearing none. Those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, say nay. Okay. A1, the amendment passed, the motion passed for the amendment and prevails. So now, Representative DePell has an oral amendment for House File 2070. Could you please share us about that amendment?
Yes, I move the oral amendment for 2070 to strike the changes on line 2.21 to 2.24, and this removes changes to paragraph F to address concerns from the Minnesota Association of Justice.
And if you could, Representative DePell, could you speak on those just a little bit more precisely?
I'd be happy to call up Mr. Holliday to speak to those issues.
Mr. State your name and just talk about that striking on that oral memo. I think that's important because we don't have that in our packet right
yes.
now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cody Holliday. Frederickson Government Relations. I represent the Alliance of Health Information Operations and Standards, who is the main primary proponent of the bill. My communications with the Minnesota Association of Justice on this oral amendment was a discrepancy in our interpretation of these of this paragraph and the changes that we were hoping to make. The current statute. With the changes that were brought forward by the Minnesota Association of Justice in 24, were to have a retrieval fee of $10. Our intent was to get the language consistent with the rest of the statute, where we're talking about records versus retrieval fees. So that was our intent, and to have that be no more than $10. The feedback that I've received from the Minnesota Association of Justice, I don't want to put words in their mouth, though, is that their interpretation would be that if we made these changes, the records would be charged at no more than $10, but a retrieval fee could be whatever you would want it to be, and that was not our intent. So instead of making the change, we'll just go with current statute on that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. Is there further discussion on the oral amendment, which strikes the changes in lines 2.21 to 2.24? Chair Liebing.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still confused about what this is doing. So it seems to me that so the way the bill is written right now, it would allow a per page fee or x-ray fee to be charged to a patient in this situation of doing this appeal, and we're striking that, right? So that so that it will go back to being more favorable to a patient who is appealing a denial. Is that right?
Mr. Holliday, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. No further follow-up on that?
I think,
okay, thank
I think
you.
I got it.
Okay. Any further discussion?
God, I hope not.
Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay, the motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Today, we also have a few testifiers. Is Sue still here? Is Sue, what, virtual? Sue?
She's at the St. Paul Grill.
Zoom, can you hear us?
Yeah, that's where she's on.
She's popping up.
We also have a few testifiers. Is Sue still here?
Yes, I am here.
Is Sue a virtual?
Okay, we have a little delay. Okay, Sue.
Can you hear us?
You need to unmute, please.
Yeah, you are unmuted.
The meeting is muted.
No.
It is not muted.
Yeah.
Is Sue
still here? Yes, I am here.
Is Sue a virtual?
Okay,
we have a little delay.
The meeting is muted.
Is Sue, can you hear us?
You need to unmute, please.
Yeah, you are unmuted.
The meeting is muted.
No. It is not muted.
Is Sue still
here?
Yes, I am here.
The audio does say it's.
I cannot hear any feedback from the meeting on my computer, yeah, but I can certainly relay message.
There seems to be, if you go to the, there's a line there, seems to be that it is not on.
Is it supposed to be
on the bottom?
No, there's one I'm supposed to be.
Is it site up
there?
Now she's on it.
Chief, I can wait.
Should I go fix it?
That's direct.
Okay, while we're working on that, we're going to do an in-person one. What's that? Liz is virtual too? Oh, okay. So we're going to go to Joel Carlson. Did you want to address the committee?
Oh, yes, he does.
And then Chuck? Chuck Shane. What's that?
Slaying with an L.
Oh, okay. SL. It's spelled differently. Okay, cool. So slain. Okay, please state your name, and we would ask to keep this to 2 minutes. Is Slain, Mr. Slain, or Mr. Carlson going to go first?
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And with your permission, I'll have Mr. Slain go first, and I have just a couple comments on the end. You're going to hear a pretty different story about the cost of medical records and the medical record companies that we deal with. This is an access to justice issue that we brought to the legislature to have corrected. And when you hear the costs of what some of these records are for a patient to get their own records, I think you'll know why we brought this bill forward.
Go ahead and do your best to keep this to 2 minutes.
Thank you. And thank you for coming here so late to listen to us talk here tonight. We appreciate it. My name is Chuck Slain, and I am a partner at TSR Injury Law. So my staff and my teams are requesting medical records every single day, hundreds of times. So I'm thoroughly familiar with the business of getting medical records from medical facilities. One thing that you heard from the proponent of our bill is that the people who are paying these bills for the records are attorneys for insurance companies. That's true, but it's also my clients, real people who have been injured, who are seeking justice. And the cost that we are charged for all these medical records gets deducted from their settlement. So the more money that someone charges for records, the less justice people get. That's why we're here. One of when we decided, was it two sessions ago now that we changed this law? The reason why we did is because these bills were just getting out of control and my clients couldn't afford to bring cases. I'll give you an example. I brought with me a medical a bill for copying one of my clients' medical records. And it's from this company called MRO, and you'll see that they provided written testimony for you in this case. They wanted $18,580 to get my client's records from one facility. He'd seen 10 facilities. I was talking with about this issue with Judy Seeberger, and she and I are both licensed in Wisconsin, and she said, you know, in Wisconsin, it's free. I couldn't believe her, because I had a client who had just spent 3 months in a hospital in Wisconsin, so I ran back to the office and requested the records electronically. Sure enough, I got them for free the next day. It took less than 24 hours to get the same amount of medical records for zero. Now, in Wisconsin, the law does not allow the medical provider to charge a fee for looking to see if there are records or verifying that the authorization has been filled out correctly. We didn't think that would be fair. So what we did is we included that they can always charge up to $20 to get paid for what it is that they're actually doing. Because keep in mind, there are no paper records that are trading hands. And if someone still has paper records that they need to deal with in their office because they haven't converted, you know what they do? They put them in a scanner and they send us the images electronically. This is the world that we live in. Now, one thing that I noted is there was testimony, I believe, in written form, talking about 47 steps, was it? 45, 47?
45.
45 steps.
And if you can wrap that up here in 30
seconds. I will
wrap
that up with this.
Thank you.
I went to MRO. Remember, that's this company. I went to their website. They're boasting about the fact that they're using AI robots to automate the tasks so that humans don't have to do anything in this process. And why do they do that? Well, they tell us right on their website, we want your employees to actually engage in higher value tasks rather than the menial task of responding to medical records. So folks, we fixed this problem already, and there's no reason to go backwards.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Carlson, do you want to?
Points just directly on the bill,
please.
Mr. Chairman and members, if I could point to lines 1.6 and 1.7. This changes the law so that a patient now has to prove that for their free request for records for their undefined own purpose, which means if you're in a car accident, your records are for the insurance company, even though you should be able to get them for free. By letting the medical records company define whether or not it's for a patient's own purpose is inconsistent with the law, and we do not accept that as a minor technical cleanup change. As to the costs themselves, we reject any per-page charge any longer, and here's why. The reason you get to an $18,000 bill is the way they generate your per-page right now is per data point. If you get your temperature taken in the hospital every hour, you get a page for that one data point for your temperature for that day. And it goes on and on and on. Every single data point is a new page.
Well, this sounds like a scam.
Anything that we do that has a per-page charge, which we got rid of ever since 2015 with the Electronic Medical Records Act that you approved, everything is electronic now. And that was just a profit-generating center, not for the hospitals, but for the medical record companies that are here promoting this change to now go 12 times higher than what we are right now. This is just unfair. It denies people their right to even find out what happened by getting an $18,000 bill just to look at the records, and we're strongly opposed to this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, now we're going, I believe, we are very ready to rock and roll on Zoom. So we have Sue Nath, Director of Minnesota Health Information. Can you hear us now?
I can. Thank you, Chairs Backer, Bierman, and members of the committee. Good evening. It is Sue Nathy. My name is Sue Nathy. I'm the Executive Director for the State of Minnesota Health Information Management Association. Minhema represents over 2,500 health information professionals across the state who support urban and rural health care organizations with managing protected health information. I'm also an experienced health information management professional with over 25 years experience working in a variety of healthcare settings in rural Minnesota. I'd like to share Minhema's support for House File 2070 and our concerns with the fee structure currently in place. The existing fees and fee caps on what providers can charge third-party requesters do not reflect the current cost of processing health information requests and protecting patient data. These fees are usually paid for by plaintiff lawyers and legal counsel for insurance companies for personal medical records. Please let me be clear. The fees and the charges that are proposed under House File 2070 only impact charges to third-party requesters and do not apply to the patient or the patient's provider who is requesting records for treatment purposes. There is no fee in these situations. There are those who believe the retrieval process for medical records is a simple push of a button, and hopefully that'll be the case someday, but it is not our current reality today. A single health system has multiple health records, including EMRs, paper, microfiche, microfilm, CDs, USB drives, a variety of systems on which protective health information is stored and still maintained today. Many healthcare organizations have large volumes of health information not interfaced on the EMR and may be stored offsite in rented facilities where they have to maintain that information. The effort to retrieve and reproduce the appropriate requested information and engage with requesters who may and often do change the parameters of a search after initial communication is not reflected in this current fee structure. It does not recognize the effort to protect the health information of the patient to comply with the HIPAA and Minnesota Health Records Acts. Again, thank you for this opportunity to share your support for House File 2070, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have when it comes to releasing data in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. And then we have one more on Zoom. We have Liz McWilly. I don't know.
McElhenney.
Thank you. Liz, you are on deck.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Backer, Chair Behrman, and committee members. My name is Liz McElhenney, and I'm a health information professional with nearly 20 years of experience. And I'm here today in support of House File 2070. While I have submitted written testimony to the committee, I would like to speak to you today about the criticality of having trained health information professionals involved in the release of information process. In doing so, I'd like to share a story from earlier in my career that demonstrates the importance of the right information being released to the right person in the right format at the right time. The encounter happened over 10 years ago, but I still remember it very clearly today. I was assisting a patient who came in with her children to request her medical records. That part was completely normal. At a certain point in the conversation, the mother motioned me over to the side and quietly asked if I could make sure that any bill would be sent directly to her attorney and not to her house. The visits she was requesting were abuse evaluations. She knew that if her husband saw an invoice for medical record copies, that he would know that she had taken the children in to be seen and that he would know that she was planning to leave him. I did not bill the patient. Patients do not get charged for their medical records. A patient's medical records contain some of the most private information about that person, including information that they may not have told a parent, a spouse, or friends. Having a trained professional to identify highly protected information, such as treatment for domestic violence and sexual assault, means that this information has the stronger privacy protections that it justifiably needs. There is a common misconception that electronic health records separate out the sensitive health information or flag it for attention, and this is not the case. It still requires individuals trained in all software systems utilized by that provider or hospital system, as well as the individual quirks of those applications. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight.
Okay, thank you. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify? I don't think so. Okay. We'll take questions, members. Representative Hewitt.
Oh, I thought there were other people in line before me.
Well, yeah, you know what? I'm so sorry. Representative Purcell, you are on deck because you were held from before, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am wondering about, is it the current fee is on line 2.10. Is it $1,500 for any request to the bill author? And then my follow-up is, then how does that change with the adjusting for inflation? Is that's the starting point? How did you get to that dollar amount? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to have Mr. Holliday come up and answer those questions. And to my best knowledge, it's up to $250 initially, and then it expands out depending on requests. But I'm going to let Mr. Holliday give you the definitives on that.
Go ahead, Mr. Holliday.
Thank you, Mr.
Holliday.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. I'm sorry, I was talking to Haas Research. Could you repeat the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. How did you land on 1500, and is that how does that adjust for inflation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. Yes, so that that dollar amount actually was we originally were going to keep it at 500, which is current statute. That number came from a medical provider over in the Senate who deals with. He does not outsource the retrieval of these records and felt that 500 was too low. In fact, his spouse processes these requests, so he felt that that number more adequately reflected the cost of processing these requests. And then that number will be adjusted with inflation going forward.
Yeah. Follow-up there, Representative Purcell. Okay. Here's, if there's no objections, we were given an extra 30 minutes and so forth. I've talked to the, communicated with the author, and with what we've talked about, there does need to be more work to this bill. So if there's no objections from members, I'm going then ask that we lay this over so they can do some additional work on this. Is there any objections to taking that path? Okay. We are in agreement. So with that there, and I thank you for everybody for being here tonight. So with that, we will be laying House File 2070 on the, what's this? As amended, we will be laying that over. Okay, members, so thank you so much for coming in this evening. Thank you for House staff. And everybody be safe, drive home safely, and we will be here on Monday with Chair Behrman with the gavel. Thank you, members. And we are adjourned.